her opinions quiet. On any issue, no one outside her inner circle knew where she stood. That made it hard for people to mirror her, to disguise their intentions behind a front of perfect agreement. Hers was a wise strategy. Another solution is to isolate the political moles, to give them no room to maneuver within the organization. Marshall accomplished this by infusing the group with his spirit of efficiency. Disruptors of that spirit stood out and could quickly be isolated. In any event, do not be naive. Once you identify the moles in the group, you must act fast to stop them from building a power base from which to destroy your authority. Finally, pay attention to the orders themselves, their form as well as their substance. Vague orders are worthless. As they pass from person to person, they are hopelessly altered, and your staff comes to see them as symbolizing uncertainty and indecision. It is critical that you yourself be clear about what you want before issuing your orders. On the other hand, if your commands are too specific and too narrow, you will encourage people to behave like automatons and stop thinking for themselves, which they must do when the situation requires it. Erring in neither direction is an art. Here, as in so much else, Napoleon was the master. His orders were full of juicy details, which gave his officers a feel for how his mind worked, while also allowing them interpretive leeway. He would often spell out possible contingencies, suggesting ways the officers could adapt his instructions if necessary. Most important, he made his orders inspiring. His language communicated the spirit of his desires. A beautifully worded order has extra power. Instead of feeling like a minion, there only to execute the wishes of a distant emperor, the recipient becomes a participant in a great cause. Bland, bureaucratic orders filter down into listless activity and imprecise execution. Clear, concise, inspiring orders make officers feel in control and fill troops with fighting spirit. Reversal. No good can ever come of divided leadership. If you are ever offered a position in which you will have to share command, turn it down, for the enterprise will fail and you will be held responsible. Better to take a lower position and let the other person have the job. It is always wise, however, to take advantage of your opponent's faulty command structure. Never be intimidated by an alliance of forces against you. If they share leadership, if they are ruled by committee, your advantage is more than enough. In fact, do as Napoleon did and seek out enemies with that kind of command structure. You cannot fail to win. Here are some further reflections on the strategy of command and control. From On War by Karl von Clausewitz. How very different is cohesion between that of an army rallying around one flag carried into battle at the personal command of one general, and that of an allied military force extending 50 or 100 leagues or even on different sides of the theater. In the first case, cohesion is at its strongest and unity at its closest. In the second case, the unity is very remote, often consisting of no more than a shared political intention, and therefore only scanty and imperfect, while the cohesion of the parts is mostly weak and often no more than an illusion. By Napoleon Bonaparte. In war, it is not men, but the man that counts. From Lone Star Preacher by Colonel John W. Thomason, Jr. An army is like a horse, in that it reflects the temper and the spirit of its rider. If there is an uneasiness and an uncertainty, it transmits itself through the reins, and the horse feels uneasy and uncertain. By Baron Antoine-Henri de Jomini. What must be the result of an operation which is but partially understood by the commander, since it is not his own conception? I have undergone a pitiable experience as prompter at headquarters, and no one has a better appreciation of the value of such services than myself. And it is particularly in a council of war that such a part is absurd. The greater the number and the higher the rank of the military officers who compose the council, the more difficult will it be to accomplish the triumph of truth and reason, however small be the amount of dissent. What would have been the action of a council of war to which Napoleon proposed the movement of Arcola, the crossing of the St. Bernard, the maneuver at Ulm, or that at Gera and Jena? The timid would have regarded them as rash, even to madness, others would have seen 1,000 difficulties of execution, and all would have concurred in rejecting them. And if, on the contrary, they had been adopted, and had been executed by anyone but Napoleon, would they not certainly have proved failures? From the Iliad, by Homer. Do you think every Greek here can be a king? It's no good having a carload of commanders. We need one commander, one king, the one to whom Zeus, son of Cronus, the crooked, has given the staff and the right to make decisions for his people. And so Odysseus mastered the army. The men all streamed back from their ships and huts and assembled with a roar. From Command in War, by Martin Van Creveld. Reports gathered and presented by the General Staff on the one hand, and by the Statistical Bureau on the other, thus constituted the most important sources of information at Napoleon's disposal. Climbing through the chain of command, however, such reports tend to become less and less specific. The more numerous the stages through which they pass, and the more standardized the form in which they are presented, the greater the danger that they will become so heavily profiled, and possibly sugar-coated, or merely distorted by the many summaries, as to become almost meaningless. To guard against this danger, and to keep subordinates on their toes, a commander needs to have, in addition, a kind of directed telescope. The metaphor is an apt one, which he can direct at will, at any part of the enemy's forces, the terrain, or his own army, in order to bring in information that is not only less structured than that passed on by the normal channels, but also tailored to meet his momentary and specific needs. Ideally, the regular reporting system should tell the commander which questions to ask, and the directed telescope should enable him to answer those questions. It was the two systems together, cutting across each other and wielded by Napoleon's masterful hand, which made the revolution in command possible. And lastly, Napoleon's written instructions to Field General, quoted in Command in War, by Martin Van Creveld. Tomorrow at dawn you depart from St. Cloud and travel to Worms, cross the Rhine there, and make sure that all preparations for the crossing of the river by my guard are being made there. You will then proceed to Kassel, and make sure that the place is being put in a state of defense and provisioned. Taking due security precautions, you will visit the fortress of Hanau. Can it be secured by a coup de main? If necessary, you will visit the citadel of Marburg, too. You will then travel on to Kassel and report to me by way of my charge d'affaires at that place, making sure that he is in fact there. The voyage from Frankfurt to Kassel is not to take place by night, for you are to observe anything that might interest me. From Kassel, you are to travel, also by day, by the shortest way to Köln. The land between Wesel, Mainz, Kassel, and Köln is to be reconnoitered. What roads and good communications exist there? Gather information about communications between Kassel and Paderborn. What is the significance of Kassel? Is the place armed and capable of resistance? Evaluate the forces of the Prince Elector in regard to their present state, their artillery, militia, strong places. From Köln, you will travel to meet me at Mainz. You are to keep to the right bank on the Rhine and submit a short appreciation of the country around Düsseldorf, Wesel, and Kassel. I shall be at Mintz on the 29th in order to receive your report. You can see for yourself how important it is for the beginning of the campaign and its progress that you should have the country well imprinted on your memory. Chapter 6. Segment your forces. The controlled chaos strategy. The critical elements in war are speed and adaptability. The ability to move and make decisions faster than the enemy. But speed and adaptability are hard to achieve today. We have more information than ever before at our fingertips, making interpretation and decision-making more difficult. We have more people to manage, those people are more widely spread, and we face more uncertainty. Learn from Napoleon, warfare's greatest master. Speed and adaptability come from flexible organization. Break your forces into independent groups that can operate and make decisions on their own. Make your forces elusive and unstoppable by infusing them with the spirit of the campaign, giving them a mission to accomplish, and then letting them run. Calculated disorder. In 1800, by defeating Austria in the Battle of Marengo, Napoleon gained control of northern Italy and forced the Austrians to sign a treaty recognizing French territorial gains there and in Belgium. For the next 5 years, an uneasy peace held sway, but Napoleon crowned himself Emperor of France, and many in Europe began to suspect that this Corsican upstart had limitless ambitions. Karl Mach, the Austrian quartermaster general and an older and influential member of the Austrian military, advocated a preemptive strike against France, with an army large enough to guarantee victory. He told his colleagues, "In war, the object is to beat the enemy, not merely to avoid being beaten." Mach and like-minded officers slowly gained influence, and in April 1805, Austria, England, and Russia signed a treaty of alliance to wage war on France and force her to return to her pre-Napoleonic borders. That summer, they formulated their plan. 95,000 Austrian troops would attack the French in northern Italy, redressing the humiliating defeat of 1800. Another 23,000 troops would secure the Tyrol between Italy and Austria. Mach would then lead a force of 70,000 men west along the Danube into Bavaria, preventing this strategically located country from allying itself with France. Once encamped in Bavaria, Mach and his army would await the arrival a few weeks later of 75,000 troops from Russia. The two armies would link up, and this unstoppable force would march west into France. Meanwhile, the English would attack the French at sea. More troops would later be funneled into each war zone, making for an army totaling 500,000 men overall, the largest military force ever assembled in Europe up to that point. Not even Napoleon could withstand an army more than twice the size of his own moving in on him from all sides. In the middle of September, Mach began his phase of the campaign by advancing along the Danube to Ulm, in the heart of Bavaria. Having established his camp there, he felt hugely satisfied. Mach loathed disorder and uncertainty. He tried to think of everything in advance, to come up with a clear plan and make sure everyone stuck to it. Clockwork warfare, he called it. He thought his plan was perfect. Nothing could go wrong. Napoleon was doomed. Mach had once been captured and forced to spend 3 years in France, where he had studied Napoleon's style of war. A key Napoleonic strategy was to make the enemy divide his forces, but now the trick was reversed. With trouble in Italy, Napoleon could not afford to send more than 70,000 French troops across the Rhine into Germany and Bavaria. The moment he crossed the Rhine, the Austrians would know his intentions and would act to slow his march. His army would need at least 2 months to reach Ulm and the Danube. By then, the Austrians would already have linked up with the Russians and swept through the Alsace and France. The strategy was as close to foolproof as any Mach had ever known. He savored the role he would play in destroying Napoleon, for he hated the man and all he represented. Undisciplined soldiers, the fomenting of revolution throughout Europe, the constant threat to the status quo. For Mach, the Russians could not arrive in Ulm too soon. Near the end of September, however, Mach began to sense something wrong. To the west of Ulm lay the Black Forest, between his own position and the French border. Suddenly, scouts were telling him that a French army was passing through the forest in his direction. Mach was bewildered. It made the best sense for Napoleon to cross the Rhine into Germany farther to the north, where his passage east would be smoother and harder to stop. But now he was yet again doing the unexpected, funneling an army through a narrow opening in the Black Forest and sending it straight at Mach. Even if this move were just a feint, Mach had to defend his position. So he sent part of his army west into the Black Forest to stem the French advance long enough for the Russians to come to his aid. A few days later, Mach began to feel horribly confused. The French were proceeding through the Black Forest, and some of their cavalry had come quite far. At the same time, though, word reached Mach of a large French army somewhere to the north of his position. The reports were contradictory. Some said this army was at Stuttgart, 60 miles northwest of Ulm. Others had it more to the east, or even farther to the north, or quite close, near the Danube. Mach could get no hard information, since the French cavalry that had come through the Black Forest blocked access to the north for reconnaissance. The Austrian general now faced what he feared most, uncertainty, and it was clouding his ability to think straight. Finally, he ordered all of his troops back to Ulm, where he would concentrate his forces. Perhaps Napoleon intended to do battle at Ulm. At least Mach would have equal numbers. In early October, Austrian scouts were at last able to find out what was really going on, and it was a nightmare. A French army had crossed the Danube to the east of Ulm, blocking Mach's way back to Austria and cutting off the Russians. Another army lay to the south, blocking his route to Italy. How could 70,000 French soldiers appear in so many places at once and move so fast? Gripped by panic, Mach sent probes in every direction. On October 11th, his men discovered a weak point. Only a small French force barred the way north and east. There he could push through and escape the French encirclement. He began to prepare for the march. But 2 days later, when he was on the point of ordering the retreat, his scouts reported that a large French force had appeared overnight, blocking the northeastern route as well. On October 20th, finding out that the Russians had decided not to come to his rescue, Mach surrendered. Over 60,000 Austrian soldiers were taken prisoner with hardly a shot fired. It was one of the most splendidly bloodless victories in history. In the next few months, Napoleon's army turned east to deal with the Russians and remaining Austrians, culminating in his spectacular victory at Austerlitz. Meanwhile, Mach languished in an Austrian prison, sentenced to 2 years for his role in this humiliating defeat. There he racked his brains, losing his sanity in the process, some said. Where had his plan gone wrong? How had an army appeared out of nowhere to his east, so easily swallowing him up? He had never seen anything like it, and he was trying to figure it out to the end of his days. Interpretation. History should not judge General Mach too harshly, for the French armies he faced in the fall of 1805 represented one of the greatest revolutions in military history. For thousands of years, war had been fought in essentially the same way. The commander led his large and unified army into battle against an opponent of roughly equal size. He would never break up his army into smaller units, for that would violate the military principle of keeping one's forces concentrated. Furthermore, scattering his forces would make them harder to monitor, and he would lose control over the battle. Suddenly, Napoleon changed all that. In the years of peace between 1800 and 1805, he reorganized the French military, bringing different forces together to form the Grande Armée, 210,000 men strong. He divided this army into several corps, each with its own cavalry, infantry, artillery, and general staff. Each was led by a marshal general, usually a young officer of proven strength in previous campaigns. Varying in size from 15,000 to 30,000 men, each corps was a miniature army headed by a miniature Napoleon. The key to the system was the speed with which the corps could move. Napoleon would give the marshals their mission, then let them accomplish it on their own. Little time was wasted with the passing of orders back and forth, and smaller armies, needing less baggage, could march with greater speed. Instead of a single army moving in a straight line, Napoleon could disperse and concentrate his corps in limitless patterns, which to the enemy seemed chaotic and unreadable. This was the monster that Napoleon unleashed on Europe in September 1805. While a few corps were dispatched to northern Italy as a holding force against Austria's planned invasion there, seven corps moved east into Germany in a scattered array. A reserve force with much cavalry was sent through the Black Forest, drawing Mach to the west, and so making it harder for him to understand what was happening to the north, and easier to entrap. Napoleon understood Mach's simple psychology, and how the appearance of disorder would paralyze him. Meanwhile, with Stuttgart as a pivot, the seven corps wheeled south to the Danube and cut off Mach's various escape routes. One corps marshal, hearing that the northeastern route was weakly held, did not wait for Napoleon to send orders, but simply sped and covered it on his own. Wherever Mach went, he would hit a corps large enough to hold him until the rest of the French army could tighten the circle. It was like a pack of coyotes against a rabbit. Understand, the future belongs to groups that are fluid, fast, and non-linear. Your natural tendency as a leader may be to want to control the group, to coordinate its every movement. But that will just tie you to the past and to the slow-moving armies of history. It takes strength of character to allow for a margin of chaos and uncertainty, to let go a little. But by decentralizing your army and segmenting it into teams, you will gain in mobility what you lose in complete control. And mobility is the greatest force multiplier of them all. It allows you to both disperse and concentrate your army, throwing it into patterns instead of advancing in straight lines. These patterns will confuse and paralyze your opponents. Give your different corps clear missions that fit your strategic goals, then let them accomplish them as they see fit. Smaller teams are faster, more creative, more adaptable. Their officers and soldiers are more engaged, more motivated. In the end, fluidity will bring you far more power and control than petty domination. By Napoleon, separate to live, unite to fight. Keys to Warfare. The world is full of people looking for a secret formula for success and power. They do not want to think on their own. They just want a recipe to follow. They are attracted to the idea of strategy for that very reason. In their minds, strategy is a series of steps to be followed toward a goal. They want these steps spelled out for them by an expert or a guru. Believing in the power of imitation, they want to know exactly what some great person has done before. Their maneuvers in life are as mechanical as their thinking. To separate yourself from such a crowd, you need to get rid of a common misconception. The essence of strategy is not to carry out a brilliant plan that proceeds in steps. It is to put yourself in situations where you have more options than the enemy does. Instead of grasping at option A as the single right answer, true strategy is positioning yourself to be able to do A, B, or C, depending on the circumstances. That is strategic depth of thinking, as opposed to formulaic thinking. Sun Tzu expressed this idea differently. What you aim for in strategy, he said, is sure, a position of potential force. The position of a boulder perched precariously on a hilltop, say, or of a bowstring stretched taut. A tap on the boulder, the release of the bowstring, and potential force is violently unleashed. The boulder or arrow can go in any direction. It is geared to the actions of the enemy. What matters is not following preordained steps, but placing yourself in sure and giving yourself options. Napoleon was probably unaware of Sun Tzu's concept of sure, yet he had perhaps history's greatest understanding of it. Once he had positioned his seven corps in their seemingly chaotic pattern along the Rhine and his reserve forces in the Black Forest, he was in sure. Wherever Mach turned, whatever he did, the Austrians were doomed. Napoleon had endless options, while Mach had only a few, and all of them bad. Napoleon had always aimed at his version of sure, and he perfected it in the 1805 campaign. Obsessed with structure and organization, he developed the corps system, building flexibility into the very skeleton of his army. The lesson is simple. A rigid, centralized organization locks you into linear strategies. A fluid, segmented army gives you options, endless possibilities for reaching sure. Structure is strategy, perhaps the most important strategic choice you will make. Should you inherit a group, analyze its structure, and alter it to suit your purposes. Pour your creative energy into its organization, making fluidity your goal. In doing so, you will be following in the footsteps not only of Napoleon, but of perhaps the greatest war machine in modern times, the Prussian and later German army. Shortly after Napoleon's devastating defeat of the Prussians at the Battle of Jena in 1806, see Chapter 2, the Prussian leaders did some soul-searching. They saw they were stuck in the past. Their way of doing things was too rigid. Suddenly, the military reformers, including Karl von Clausewitz, were taken seriously and given power. And what they decided to do was unprecedented in history. They would institutionalize success by designing a superior army structure. At the core of this revolution was the creation of a general staff, a cadre of officers specially trained and educated in strategy, tactics, and leadership. A king, a prime minister, or even a general might be incompetent at war, but a group of brilliant and well-trained officers on the army staff could compensate for his failures. The structure of this body was unfixed. Each new chief of staff could alter its size and function to suit his needs and the times. After each campaign or training exercise, the staff would rigorously examine itself and its performance. A whole section was created for the purpose of these examinations and for the study of military history. The general staff would learn from its mistakes and those of others. It was to be a work permanently in progress. The most important reform was the development of the Auftragstaktik, mission-oriented command system. In German, there are two words for command, Auftrag and Befehl. A Befehl is an order to be obeyed to the letter. An Auftrag is much more general. It is a statement of overall mission, a directive to be followed in its spirit, not its letter. The Auftragstaktik, inspired by Prussia's archenemy Napoleon and the leeway he gave his marshals, permeated the general staff. Officers were first inculcated with the philosophy of German warfare. Speed, the need to take the offensive, and so on. Then they were put through exercises to help them develop their ability to think on their own, to make decisions that met the overall philosophy but responded to the circumstances of the moment. Leading the equivalent of a corps in battle, officers were given missions to accomplish and then were let loose. They were judged by the results of their actions, not on how those results were achieved. The general staff, with a few interruptions, was in place from 1808 to the end of World War II. During that period, the Germans consistently outfought other armies in the field, including the Allies in World War I, despite the severe limitations of trench warfare. Their success culminated in the most devastating military victory in modern history, the 1940 Blitzkrieg invasion of France and the Low Countries, when the German army ran rings around the rigid defenses of the French. It was the structure of their army and their use of the Auftragstaktik that gave them more options and greater potential force. The German general staff should serve as the organizational model for any group that aims at mobility and strategic depth. First, the staff's structure was fluid, allowing its leaders to adapt it to their own needs. Second, it examined itself constantly and modified itself according to what it had learned. Third, it replicated its structure through the rest of the Army. Its officers trained the officers below them, and so on down the line. The smallest team was inculcated with the overall philosophy of the group. Finally, rather than issuing rigid orders, the staff embraced the mission command, the Auftragstaktik. By making officers and soldiers feel more creatively engaged, this tactic improved their performance and sped up the decision-making process. Mobility was written into the system. The key to the Auftragstaktik is an overall group philosophy. This can be built around the cause you are fighting for or a belief in the evil of the enemy you face. It can also include the style of warfare, defensive, mobile, ruthlessly aggressive, that best suits it. You must bring the group together around this belief. Then, through training and creative exercises, you must deepen its hold on them, infuse it into their blood. Now, when you unleash your core on their missions, you can trust their decisions and feel confident in your power to coordinate them. The Mongol hordes led by Genghis Khan in the first half of the 13th century were perhaps the closest precursors to Napoleon's corps. Genghis, who preached a philosophy of Mongol superiority, was a master of mobility in warfare. His segmented forces could disperse and concentrate in complicated patterns. The armies that faced them were shocked at how chaotic they seemed, so impossible to figure out. Yet they maneuvered with amazing coordination. Mongol soldiers knew what to do and when without being told. For their victims, the only explanation was that they were possessed by the devil. The sinister coordination of the Mongols, however, was actually the result of rigorous training. Every winter in peacetime, Genghis would run the Great Hunt, a 3-month-long operation in which he would scatter the entire Mongol army along an 80-mile line in the steppes of Central Asia and what is now Mongolia. A flag in the ground hundreds of miles away marked the hunt's endpoint. The line would advance, driving before it all the animals in its path. Slowly, in an intricately choreographed maneuver, the ends of the line would curve to form a circle, trapping the animals within. The hunt's endpoint would form the center of the circle. As the circle tightened, the animals were killed. The most dangerous of them, the tigers, were left till last. The Great Hunt exercised the Mongols' ability to communicate through signals at a distance, coordinate their movements with precision, know what to do in different circumstances, and act without waiting for orders. Even bravery became an exercise when individual soldiers would have to take on a tiger. Through hunting and a form of play, Genghis could instill his philosophy, develop cohesion and trust among his men, and tighten his army's discipline. In unifying your own hordes, find exercises to increase your troops' knowledge of and trust in each other. This will develop implicit communication skills between them and their intuitive sense of what to do next. Time will not then be wasted in the endless transmission of messages and orders, or in constantly monitoring your troops in the field. If you can disguise these exercises as play, as in the Great Hunt, so much the better. Throughout the 1940s and 50s, two great baseball organizations did battle. The Boston Red Sox, built around Ted Williams, and the New York Yankees, with their great hitter, Joe DiMaggio. The owner of the Red Sox, Tom Yawkey, believed in pampering his players, creating a pleasant environment for them, developing friendships with them. A happy team would play well, he thought. For this purpose, he went drinking with his men, played cards with them, checked them into nice hotels on tour. He also meddled in managerial decisions, always with an eye toward making things better for his players and keeping them happy. The Yankees' philosophy was very different, emphasizing discipline and victory at all costs. The organization's separate parts stayed out of one another's business. They understood the team ethos and knew they would be judged on results. The manager was left to make his own decisions. Yankee players felt an intense need to live up to the team's winning traditions. They were afraid of losing. In those two decades, the Red Sox players fought among themselves, fell into factions, whined and complained at any perceived slight, and won just one pennant. The Yankees were cohesive and spirited. They won 13 pennants and 10 World Series. The lesson is simple. Do not confuse a chummy, club-like atmosphere with team spirit and cohesion. Coddling your soldiers and acting as if everyone were equal will ruin discipline and promote the creation of factions. Victory will forge stronger bonds than superficial friendliness, and victory comes from discipline, training, and ruthlessly high standards. Finally, you need to structure your group according to your soldiers' strengths and weaknesses, to their social circumstances. To do that, you must be attuned to the human side of your troops. You must understand them and the spirit of the times inside and out. During the American Civil War, the Union generals struggled with the ragtag nature of their army. Unlike the disciplined, well-trained troops of the Confederacy, many Northern soldiers had been forcibly conscripted at the last minute. They were pioneers, rugged frontiersmen, and they were fiercely independent. Some generals tried desperately to instill discipline, and mostly they failed. Others just paid attention to map strategy while their armies continued to perform badly. General William Tecumseh Sherman had a different solution. He changed his organization to suit the personalities of his men. He created a more democratic army, encouraged initiative in his officers, let them dress as they saw fit. He loosened outward discipline to foster morale and group spirit. Like frontiersmen generally, his soldiers were restless and nomadic, so he exploited their mobility and kept his army in perpetual motion, always marching faster than his enemies could. Of all the Union armies, Sherman's were the most feared and performed the best. Like Sherman, do not struggle with your soldiers' idiosyncrasies, but rather turn them into a virtue, a way to increase your potential force. Be creative with the group's structure, keeping your mind as fluid and adaptable as the army you lead. Reversal. Since the structure of your army has to be suited to the people who compose it, the rule of decentralization is flexible. Some people respond better to rigid authority. Even if you run a looser organization, there may be times when you will have to tighten it and give your officers less freedom. Wise generals set nothing in stone, always retaining the ability to reorganize their army to fit the times and their changing needs. Here are further reflections on the strategy of controlled chaos. From Command in War by Martin Van Creveld. Finally, a most important point to be considered is that the revolutionary system of command employed by Napoleon was the outcome not of any technological advances, as one might expect, but merely of superior organization and doctrine. The technical means at the emperor's disposal were not a whit more sophisticated than those of his opponents. He differed from them in that he possessed the daring and ingenuity needed to transcend the limits that technology had imposed on commanders for thousands of years. Whereas Napoleon's opponents sought to maintain control and minimize uncertainty by keeping their forces closely concentrated, Napoleon chose the opposite way, reorganizing and decentralizing his army in such a way as to enable its parts to operate independently for a limited period of time and consequently tolerate a higher degree of uncertainty. Rather than allowing the technological means at hand to dictate the method of strategy and the functioning of command, Napoleon made profitable use of the very limitations imposed by the technology. From Military Misfortunes, The Anatomy of Failure in War, by Elliot A. Cohen and John Gooch. We find our attention drawn repeatedly to what one might call the organizational dimension of strategy. Military organizations and the states that develop them periodically assess their own ability to handle military threats. When they do so, they tend to look at that which can be quantified: the number of troops, the quantities of ammunition, the readiness rates of key equipment, the amount of transport, and so on. Rarely, however, do they look at the adequacy of their organization as such, and particularly high-level organization, to handle these challenges. Yet, as Pearl Harbor and other cases suggest, it is in the deficiency of organizations that the embryo of misfortune develops. From Command in War by Martin Van Creveld. The fact that, historically speaking, those armies have been most successful which did not turn their troops into automatons, did not attempt to control everything from the top, and allowed subordinate commanders considerable latitude, has been abundantly demonstrated. The Roman centurions and military tribunes, Napoleon's marshals, Moltke's army commanders, Ludendorff's storm detachments, all these are examples, each within its own stage of technological development, of the way things were done in some of the most successful military forces ever. From Patton, A Genius for War, by Carlo d'Este. Patton's philosophy of command was, "Never tell people how to do things, tell them what to do, and they will surprise you with their ingenuity." From The Iliad, by Homer. Agamemnon smiled and moved on. Coming next to the two captains who shared the name Ajax, as they were strapping on their helmets. Behind them a cloud of infantry loomed. Agamemnon was glad to see them, and his words flew out. "Ajax, both of you, Achaean commanders, I would be out of line if I issued you orders. You push your men to fight hard on your own. By Father Zeus, by Athena and Apollo, if all of my men had your kind of heart, King Priam's city would soon bow her head, taken and ravaged under our hands." From A Genius for War, The German Army and General Staff, 1807 to 1945, by Colonel T. N. Dupuy. It was during this period of post-war introspection and evaluation that one of the fundamental military concepts of Scharnhorst and Gneisenau coalesced into a clearly defined doctrine understandable to and understood by all officers in the army. This was the concept of Auftragstaktik, or mission tactics. Moltke himself inserted in the draft of a new tactical manual for senior commanders the following lines: "A favorable situation will never be exploited if commanders wait for orders. The highest commander and the youngest soldier must always be conscious of the fact that omission and inactivity are worse than resorting to the wrong expedient." Nothing epitomized the outlook and performance of the German General Staff and of the German Army which it coordinated more than this concept of mission tactics, the responsibility of each German officer and non-commissioned officer to do without question or doubt whatever the situation required as he saw it. This meant that he should act without awaiting orders if action seemed necessary. It also meant that he should act contrary to orders if these did not seem to be consistent with the situation. To make perfectly clear that action contrary to orders was not considered either as disobedience or lack of discipline, German commanders began to repeat one of Moltke's favorite stories of an incident observed while visiting the headquarters of Prince Frederick Charles. A major, receiving a tongue-lashing from the prince for a tactical blunder, offered the excuse that he had been obeying orders, and reminded the prince that a Prussian officer was taught that an order from a superior was tantamount to an order from the king. Frederick Charles promptly responded, "His Majesty made you a major because he believed you would know when not to obey his orders." This simple story became guidance for all following generations of German officers. From Hitter, The Life and Turmoils of Ted Williams, by Ed Lynn. Tom Yawkey was 30 years old when he bought the Red Sox, a hopelessly bankrupt team that had won only 43 games the previous season and averaged only 2,365 paying customers. The ball club became his toy. Because he loved his players, he spoiled them rotten. And because he spoiled them rotten, they praised him to the skies. There is a well-publicized exchange in which Bobby Doerr asks Tommy Henrik why the Red Sox weren't able to beat the Yankees in big games. "Weren't we good enough?" Doerr asks. "It wasn't that they weren't good enough," Henrik answers. "Your owner was too good to you. The Red Sox didn't have to get into the World Series to drive Cadillacs. The Yankees did." The Red Sox organization was an amateur operation, pitted against the toughest, most professional operation of all time. And lastly, by T. E. Lawrence. In a real sense, maximum disorder was our equilibrium. Chapter 7. Transform Your War into a Crusade. Morale Strategies. The secret to motivating people and maintaining their morale is to get them to think less about themselves and more about the group. Involve them in a cause, a crusade against a hated enemy. Make them see their survival as tied to the success of the army as a whole. In a group in which people have truly bonded, moods and emotions are so contagious that it becomes easy to infect your troops with enthusiasm. Lead from the front. Let your soldiers see you in the trenches, making sacrifices for the cause. That will fill them with a desire to emulate and please you. Make both rewards and punishments rare but meaningful. Remember, a motivated army can work wonders, making up for any lack of material resources. The Art of Man Management. We humans are selfish by nature. Our first thoughts in any situation revolve around our own interests. How will this affect me? How will it help me? At the same time, by necessity, we try to disguise our selfishness, making our motives look altruistic or disinterested. Our inveterate selfishness and our ability to disguise it are problems for you as a leader. You may think that the people working for you are genuinely enthusiastic and concerned. That is what they say. That is what their actions suggest. Then slowly you see signs that this person or that is using his or her position in the group to advance purely personal interests. One day you wake up to find yourself leading an army of selfish, conniving individuals. That is when you start thinking about morale, about finding a way to motivate your troops and forge them into a group. Perhaps you try artfully to praise people, to offer them the possibility of reward, only to find you have spoiled them, strengthening their selfishness. Perhaps you try punishments and discipline, only to make them resentful and defensive. Perhaps you try to fire them up with speeches and group activities. But people are cynical nowadays. They will see right through you. The problem is not what you are doing, but the fact that it comes late. You have begun to think about morale only after it has become an issue, not before. That is your mistake. Learn from history's great motivators and military leaders. The way to get soldiers to work together and maintain morale is to make them feel part of a group that is fighting for a worthy cause. That distracts them from their own interests and satisfies their human need to feel part of something bigger than they are. The more they think of the group, the less they think of themselves. They soon begin to link their own success to the group's. Their own interests and the larger interests coincide. In this kind of army, people know that selfish behavior will disgrace them in the eyes of their companions. They become attuned to a kind of group conscience. Morale is contagious. Put people in a cohesive, animated group and they naturally catch that spirit. If they rebel or revert to selfish behavior, they are easily isolated. You must establish this dynamic the minute you become the group's leader. It can only come from the top, that is, from you. The ability to create the right group dynamic, to maintain the collective spirit, is known in military language as man management. History's great generals, Alexander the Great, Hannibal, Napoleon, were all masters of the art, which for military men is more than simply important. In battle, it can be the deciding issue, a matter of life and death. In war, Napoleon once said, the moral is to the physical as 3-1. He meant that his troops' fighting spirit was crucial in the outcome of the battle. With motivated soldiers, he could beat an army 3 times the size of his own. To create the best group dynamic and prevent destructive morale problems, follow these 8 crucial steps culled from the writings and experiences of the masters of the art. It is important to follow as many of the steps as possible. None is less important than any other. Step 1. Unite your troops around a cause. Make them fight for an idea. Now more than ever, people have a hunger to believe in something. They feel an emptiness, which, left alone, they might try to fill with drugs or spiritual fads, but you can take advantage of it by channeling it into a cause you can convince them is worth fighting for. Bring people together around a cause, and you create a motivated force. The cause can be anything you wish, but you should represent it as progressive. It fits the times. It is on the side of the future, so it is destined to succeed. If necessary, you can give it a veneer of spirituality. It is best to have some kind of enemy to hate. An enemy can help a group to define itself in opposition. Ignore this step, and you are left with an army of mercenaries. You will deserve the fate that usually awaits such armies. Step 2. Keep their bellies full. People cannot stay motivated if their material needs go unmet. If they feel exploited in any way, their natural selfishness will come to the surface, and they will begin to peel off from the group. Use a cause, something abstract or spiritual, to bring them together, but meet their material needs. You do not have to spoil them by overpaying them. A paternalistic feeling that they are being taken care of, that you are thinking of their comfort, is more important. Attending to their physical needs will make it easier to ask more of them when the time comes. Step 3. Lead from the front. The enthusiasm with which people join a cause inevitably wanes. One thing that speeds up its loss and that produces discontent is the feeling that the leaders do not practice what they preach. Right from the beginning, your troops must see you leading from the front, sharing their dangers and sacrifices, taking the cause as seriously as they do. Instead of trying to push them from behind, make them run to keep up with you. Step 4. Concentrate their qi. There is a Chinese belief in an energy called qi, which dwells in all living things. All groups have their own level of qi, physical and psychological. A leader must understand this energy and know how to manipulate it. Idleness has a terrible effect on qi. When soldiers are not working, their spirits lower. Doubts creep in, and selfish interests take over. Similarly, being on the defensive, always waiting, and reacting to what the enemy dishes out will also lower qi. So keep your soldiers busy, acting for a purpose, moving in a direction. Do not make them wait for the next attack. Propelling them forward will excite them and make them hungry for battle. Aggressive action concentrates qi, and concentrated qi is full of latent force. Step 5. Play to their emotions. The best way to motivate people is not through reason, but through emotion. Humans, however, are naturally defensive, and if you begin with an appeal to their emotions, some histrionic harangue, they will see you as manipulative and will recoil. An emotional appeal needs a setup. Lower their defenses, and make them bond as a group by putting on a show, entertaining them, telling a story. Now they have less control over their emotions, and you can approach them more directly, moving them easily from laughter to anger or hatred. Masters of man management have a sense of drama. They know when and how to hit their soldiers in the gut. Step 6. Mix harshness and kindness. The key to man management is a balance of punishment and reward. Too many rewards will spoil your soldiers and make them take you for granted. Too much punishment will destroy their morale. You need to hit the right balance. Make your kindness rare, and even an occasional warm comment or generous act will be powerfully meaningful. Anger and punishment should be equally rare. Instead, your harshness should take the form of setting very high standards that few can reach. Make your soldiers compete to please you. Make them struggle to see less harshness and more kindness. Step 7. Build the group myth. The armies with the highest morale are armies that have been tested in battle. Soldiers who have fought alongside one another through many campaigns forge a kind of group myth based on their past victories. Living up to the tradition and reputation of the group becomes a matter of pride. Anyone who lets it down feels ashamed. To generate this myth, you must lead your troops into as many campaigns as you can. It is wise to start out with easy battles that they can win, building up their confidence. Success alone will help bring the group together. Create symbols and slogans that fit the myth. Your soldiers will want to belong. Step 8. Be ruthless with grumblers. Allow grumblers and the chronically disaffected any leeway at all, and they will spread disquiet and even panic throughout the group. As fast as you can, you must isolate them and get rid of them. All groups contain a core of people who are more motivated and disciplined than the rest, your best soldiers. Recognize them, cultivate their goodwill, and set them up as examples. These people will serve as natural ballasts against those who are disaffected and panicky. By Xenophon. You know, I am sure, that not numbers or strength brings victory in war. But whichever army goes into battle stronger in soul, their enemies generally cannot withstand them. Historical examples. 1. In the early 1630s, Oliver Cromwell, 1599 to 1658, a provincial gentleman farmer in Cambridgeshire, England, fell victim to a depression and to constant thoughts of death. Deep in crisis, he converted to the Puritan religion, and suddenly his life took a new turn. He felt he had experienced a direct communion with God. Now he believed in providence, the idea that everything happens for a reason and according to God's will. Whereas before he had been despondent and indecisive, now he was filled with purpose. He thought himself among God's elect. Eventually, Cromwell became a member of Parliament and a vocal defender of the common people in their grievances against the aristocracy. Yet he felt marked by providence for something larger than politics. He had visions of a great crusade. In 1642, Parliament, in a bitter struggle with Charles I, voted to cut off the king's funds until he agreed to limits on royal power. When Charles refused, civil war broke out between the Cavaliers, supporters of the king who wore their hair long, and the Roundheads, the rebels, so-called because they cropped their hair short. Parliament's most fervent supporters were Puritans like Cromwell, who saw the war against the king as his chance. More than his chance, his calling. Although Cromwell had no military background, he hurriedly formed a troop of 60 horsemen from his native Cambridgeshire. His aim was to incorporate them in a large regiment, gain military experience by fighting under another commander, and slowly prove his worth. He was confident of ultimate victory, for he saw his side as unbeatable. After all, God was on their side, and all his men were believers in the cause of creating a more pious England. Despite his lack of experience, Cromwell was something of a military visionary. He imagined a new kind of warfare spearheaded by a faster, more mobile cavalry, and in the war's first few months he proved a brave and effective leader. He was given more troops to command, but soon realized that he had grossly overestimated the fighting spirit of those on his side. Time and again he led cavalry charges that pierced enemy lines, only to watch in disgust as his soldiers broke order to plunder the enemy camp. Sometimes he tried to hold part of his force in reserve to act as reinforcements later in the battle, but the only command they listened to was to advance, and in retreat they were hopelessly disordered. Representing themselves as crusaders, Cromwell's men were revealed by battle as mercenaries, fighting for pay and adventure. They were useless. In 1643, when Cromwell was made a colonel at the head of his own regiment, he decided to break with the past. From now on, he would recruit only soldiers of a certain kind, men who, like himself, had experienced religious visions and revelations. He sounded out the aspirants, tested them for the depth of their faith. Departing from a long tradition, he appointed commoners, not aristocrats, as officers. As he wrote to a friend, "I had rather have a plain russet-coated captain that knows what he fights for and loves what he knows, than that which you call a gentleman and is nothing else." Cromwell made his recruits sing psalms and pray together. In a stern check on bad discipline, he taught them to see all their actions as part of God's plan. And he looked after them in an unusual way for the times, making sure they were well-fed, well-clothed, and promptly paid. When Cromwell's army went into battle, it was now a force to reckon with. The men rode in tight formation, loudly singing psalms. As they neared the king's forces, they would break into a pretty round trot, not the headlong and disorderly charge of other troops. Even in contact with the enemy, they kept their order, and they retreated with as much discipline as when they advanced. Since they believed that God was with them, they had no fear of death. They could march straight up a hill into enemy fire without breaking step. Having gained control over his cavalry, Cromwell could maneuver them with infinite flexibility. His troops won battle after battle. In 1645, Cromwell was named Lieutenant General of the Cavalry in the new model army. That year, at the Battle of Naseby, his disciplined regiment was crucial in the Roundheads' victory. A few days later, his cavalry finished off the Royalist forces at Langport, effectively putting an end to the first stage of the Civil War. Interpretation. That Cromwell is generally considered one of history's great military leaders is all the more remarkable given that he learned soldiery on the job. During the second stage of the Civil War, he became head of the Roundhead armies, and later, after defeating King Charles and having him executed, he became Lord Protector of England. Although he was ahead of his times with his visions of mobile warfare, Cromwell was not a brilliant strategist or field tactician. His success lay in the morale and discipline of his cavalry, and the secret to those was the quality of the men he recruited, true believers in his cause. Such men were naturally open to his influence and accepting of his discipline. With each new victory, they grew more committed to him and more cohesive. He could ask the most of them. Above all else, then, pay attention to your staff, to those you recruit to your cause. Many will pretend to share your beliefs, but your first battle will show that all they wanted was a job. Soldiers like these are mercenaries and will get you nowhere. True believers are what you want. Expertise and impressive resumes matter less than character and the capacity for sacrifice. Recruits of character will give you a staff already open to your influence, making morale and discipline infinitely easier to attain. This core personnel will spread the gospel for you, keeping the rest of the army in line. As far as possible in this secular world, make battle a religious experience, and ecstatic involvement in something transcending the present. 2. In 1931, the 23-year-old Lyndon Baines Johnson was offered the kind of job he had been dreaming of, secretary to Richard Clayburgh, newly elected congressman from Texas's 14th congressional district. Johnson was a high school debating teacher at the time, but he had worked on several political campaigns and was clearly a young man of ambition. His students at Sam Houston High in Houston, Texas, assumed that he would quickly forget about them, but to the surprise of two of his best debaters, L.E. Jones and Gene Latimer, he not only kept in touch, he wrote to them regularly from Washington. 6 months later came a bigger surprise still. Johnson invited Jones and Latimer to Washington to work as his assistants. With the Depression at its height, jobs were scarce, particularly jobs with this kind of potential. The two teenagers grabbed the opportunity. Little did they know what they were in for. The pay was ridiculously low, and it soon became clear that Johnson intended to work the two men to their human limit. They put in 18 or 20 hour days, mostly answering constituents' mail. The chief has a knack, or better said, a genius, for getting the most out of those around him, Latimer later wrote. He'd say, "Gene, it seems L.E.'s a little faster than you today." And I'd work faster. "L.E., he's catching up with you." And pretty soon we'd both be pounding the typewriter for hours without stopping, just as fast as we could. Jones didn't usually take orders too well, but he found himself working harder and harder for Johnson. His boss seemed destined for something great. That Johnson would scale the heights of power was written all over his face, and he would bring the ambitious Jones along with him. Johnson could also turn everything into a cause, making even the most trivial issue a crusade for Clayburgh's constituents, and Jones felt part of that crusade, part of history. The most important